short prophecy into a jar. Let me just read it quickly as well. The signs will be there for all to read. When man shall do most heinous deed, man will ruin kinder lives by taking them as to their wives. A murder foul and brutal deed, when man will only think of greed, a man shall walk as if asleep, and he does not look, he may not peep, and iron men the tail shall do, and iron cart and carriage too. The king shall false promise make, and talk just for talking's sake. That does sound like a few political leaders I've heard. And nations plan horrific war, the like as never seen before, and taxes rise and lively down, and nations wear perpetual frown. Yet greater sign there be to see as man nears the latter part of the century. Three sleeping mountains gather breath and spew out mud and ice and death. An earthquake swallow town and town and lands as yet to me unknown. And Christian one fights Christian two and nations sigh, yet nothing do. And yellow men great power gain from the mighty bear with whom they've lain. These mighty tyrants failed to do, they failed to split the world in two. But from their acts, a danger bred, an ague leaving many dead, and physics finds no remedy, for this is worse than leprosy. Oh, many signs for all to see the truth of this true prophecy. Well, that's Elizabeth Sonfeld, powerful vision of our day and time. So many of them so accurate, you have to say, well, I'm afraid some of these others we better watch for. I wanted to quickly mention also Nostradamus. Obviously, his quatrains have been studied for years and years. He certainly is another one who saw what was taking place in our day and time. As we talk about they saw our day, he clearly was another one that did see our day. I want to talk about another individual that fits in with many of these other cultures. This was also one of the greatest stories I think I've ever come upon in this research. The story is about a man named Daganoweda. There's a lot of questions about where he came from. Some of the sources I searched, including encyclopedias, actually said, well, he was claimed to have been a god. They didn't know where he came from. He suddenly came upon the Iroquois people. Others said that he was of Huron birth. The truth, I guess, may not be known for a period of time. Daganoweda came to the Iroquois nations in the 1500s, and they called him the peacemaker. And Daganoweda taught the people of a way to live in peace and harmony. Now, when he came to these different nations of the Iroquois, these were the Seneca, the Mohawk, the Oneida, Onondaga, the Cayuga, and the Tuscarora. Many of the people accepted his message right off and thought, whoa, this is great. Taught them what he called the great law of justice, set up a system of checks and balances, rules of procedures, limits of power, and with a major stress on individual liberty. Does that sound familiar? This man went amongst the people trying to convince them of the importance of this plan of peace. And most of the people were very accepting of what he had to say, but some of them were not so much. And they said to him, all right, there's an old hermit that lives in the forest that is a beast, and he is an angry man. And if you can go and convert this man to the plan, then we will be certain that all of the tribes will accept this. So he went to this man named Hiawatha. And Hiawatha had his daughters slaughtered in an Indian raid, and he was very, very upset because of what had taken place to him. And because of it, he had rejected society and had great anger. Daganoweda went to Hiawatha and shared with him his plan for peace and cried with him. And when they were finished, Hiawatha was completely converted unto this plan. And he left at that moment with Daganoweda and traveled with him through the remainder of Daganoweda's time with these people, which was quite a period of time. It was said that Daganoweda told the people that he was slow of speech from the time he was born and had a stuttering problem. Because of that, he asked Hiawatha to be his spokesperson and to speak in his place in many situations. Well, as the people came together, they formed this, what they called the Iroquois Confederacy, and had what they called the Iroquois Constitution or League. When they came upon problems in their life, they were to seek first for help from their immediate family. And then if that was not enough, they turned to their extended family in the longhouses. And if that was not enough, their extended family from there was their entire tribe. And if that was not enough, they would turn to the Confederacy or the League. Well, it was a system that worked. And they said that when the European settlers started coming into our land and found this Iroquois nation, it was so powerful that it was really a force to be reckoned with. When they came in, they started breaking the Iroquois Confederacy apart. They started taking sides, some with the Americans, some with the Europeans, some with the French. It became a situation where eventually destroyed the Iroquois Confederacy. But the people for a long period of time, 100 or so years, lived in this league under the concepts that Daganoweda taught to these people. And he told them that one of the aspects that was really key to their society was that all people had to be equal in stature, that no one could be greater than another. And one of the most important aspects of that was men and women, that women had as much equality in their society as the men did. In fact, they had what they called the Council of Grandmothers. Now, they would nominate and elect, in a sense, I guess, the representatives from each of the tribes. They, interestingly enough, had 50 representatives, and each had one vote in this confederacy. Now, here's a part where I thought was most interesting. They had to make decisions by unanimous consent, by a consensus. A majority would not do, and they would continue to meet until they could reach consensus. Then the decisions were then taken to the Council of Grandmothers. Because of their compassion and sensitivity and meekness, they believed that the woman had the ability to help them in making those final decisions. And so therefore, the men being the representatives, but the women would have a final say on what would take place. He taught them some very important principles on which to base their life. The day came when he came to the people and he told them, "I must leave. The Creator has called me to another work. But before I leave, I want to speak to you one last time." And so they brought the people together on the Bay of Quinte, which is near Lake Ontario today. He spoke to them one last time. Now, interestingly enough, he asked them to dig a trench, and they buried their weapons of war and took an oath to not take them up again. They took a tree and planted it over the top, and he called it the representation of the Tree of Life. This tree they planted on an island out in the middle of the lake, mostly covered with granite. The white granite was to represent the purity and was a symbol very much like the wampum belt that was used by the Indian women as a representation of their purity during that time. Well, he spoke to them, and here are the principles he said he wanted to make sure they always remember. First was purity of mind and body. The moral stability of the people was most important. Second, he told them to seek to become one with the great Creator. The spiritual stability of the people was most crucial to the success of the society. Third, a society must maintain a council and force for self-defense, but it must be tempered by the guidance of spiritual understandings, he said. Thus, when a conflict arises, the councils of the people must include the military and spiritual leaders to make a decision as to how to deal with the problem. And then they would go to the Council of Grandmothers in making that final decision. Fourth, our action is the expression of true thought. By going out and doing good for others, we show this action. By so giving, we receive. And this is certainly a principle we found in every single one of these cultures that did reach a type of utopian society, was the fact that they spent time serving others. They really realized the principle that by giving, they receive. Both the giver and the receiver receive. The last two, justice and equality must be maintained in dealing with human rights. And sixth, the strength of the system relies on the strength of the family. All societal relationships depend on it. He concluded by telling them, seek the good of the whole. The time would come when selfishness would become the mode of society. Now, Daganoweda prophesied to them. He told them about a great prophecy that to this day, all those different tribes tell the story. And I received this from a Cherokee Indian. Found some fascinating information that the Reader's Digest had done study on Daganoweda and his life and what had taken place and the prophecy that he gave. But he told them that the time would come when a white serpent would come amongst them. And the white serpent would seek to be their friends at first and then would take power over them and almost crush them. Then the time would come later on when this white serpent would be attacked by a red serpent. And this red serpent would have such a hold upon the white serpent would forget everything else and begin to fight with this red serpent. And the red serpent would have almost destroyed the white serpent. The Indians, he told them, that they were not to become involved in the war, but that if they would go the hills, they would be safe. And as they were about to be destroyed, a black serpent would come up out of the sea and would come forward and begin to thrash the red serpent and the white serpent. would kill the red serpent and would almost have killed the white serpent. The white serpent would be laying almost dead, and the black serpent would rise up on its chest and begin to celebrate its victory. When suddenly a great burst of light would come down out of heaven. And in this light, there would be a power that would overcome and destroy this black serpent and give power back to the white serpent to live. The remaining of the life of that white serpent would raise up and go forward in a repentant state and go and join with the Indian people and would create a society of peace. He told them that at that time, when the white serpent came crawling back to them and to join with them, they were to call upon the Creator and ask that Daganoweda would return to join with them. Well, there have been a lot of theories as to who Daganoweda is and who he may be. You could see a correlation with the life of this man, Enoch, of which this book is written about. The story at the end is the fact that he became translated and was taken up unto God, as the Bible tells, and that did not taste of death. And there are those that say, oh, I think it's the prophet Enoch come back. Whoever he is, interestingly enough, in, I think it was 1743, there was a young man by the name of Benjamin Franklin that came upon the story of Daganoweda and of the culture that he had formed and studied it and decided this was an incredible system. So great was the system, in his opinion, that he developed a plan called the Albany Plan based on the Iroquois Constitution. And he proposed it to the colonies as a way to bring a similar confederation. Franklin's proposal languished for several decades. And then in one day in Philadelphia, the delegates turned to its provisions and made it the major piece of the final Constitution of the United States of America. Now, it's interesting to note that it was not only a piece of the details of the Constitution, but also the American Eagle came from the Iroquois nation and their Constitution. It was their symbol, national symbol of peace. And Franklin and others decided that the eagle should also be the symbol of their peace. The Iroquois, they have the eagle sitting in a tree. They call it the Tree of Peace, and it's holding six arrows representing the six nations of the Iroquois nation. And, of course, the American Eagle is holding 13, representing the 13 original member states. Well, I thought that was really interesting to see that our founding fathers had learned a great deal from their red-faced brothers, as well as from prophecy. Many of you may have heard of the fact that George Washington had a great prophetic view of our day, a most powerful story that fits in great detail with what Daganoweda told the Iroquois nations. He saw the Revolutionary War to its conclusion. He saw that we won. He saw the Civil War. He saw the reason for the war was because of an issue developed around slavery. He saw that later on there was a greater war, that all the nations of the earth came against our country, and that it was almost destroyed, as in many of these other prophecies, but that the American nation was given power from light from heaven, which came upon them and gave them the strength to persevere and win, and that they then made a union that lasted forever. Well, in a nutshell, that is what Washington saw. We found that there were a fair number of them, Benjamin Franklin being one, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, a number of them believed very deeply that what they were doing was building the foundation for that last day Zion that the Bible spoke of. The Bible being one of the main documents they actually used in creating the Constitution, as they studied that, they really believed that the time had come in which they were to help build what some of them called the New Jerusalem. In fact, we found in a couple different books from that time period telling about the people in the New England states were calling themselves the New Jerusalem. They believed that it was time and that they were building the foundation upon which the great last Zion would be built. And so it goes. The Indians, the cultures all over the world, all of us have had a chance to see a day and time when such a thing would take place. Now, when we talk about solutions, probably the most common thread amongst all of these different cultures, as I've mentioned before, was they talked about the fact that if the family is destroyed, the society will be destroyed. Clearly to us, that should be a message of what is so critical to us. As I stood there next to death, I knew there was nothing more important in my life than my family and my relationship with my God. But suddenly, nothing else matters. And unfortunately, we are living in a day and time when all too many of us have forgotten what really is important. I believe very firmly that the solutions that these different societies have come up with, one being by giving you receive, and another being by serving others, we really do create the good for the whole. These are powerful concepts that are really something that brings the power to create this time of peace. I want to conclude by just telling you a real quick story. I had the opportunity to test out this principle of service. A year ago, my family and I, after having come upon some of these solutions from these different utopian societies, I realized, what would it be like if you actually just spent, you know, some time just going out and serving people only? And so my family and I, we came up with an idea of going for a 2-week vacation. All we did was just go from town to town, place to place, just going, trying to help people. It was a very interesting experience. My teenage son at first going, oh, come on, Dad, you gotta be kidding. You really want to do this? And my wife had a few questions about whether I lost my head or not, but we decided to do it anyway. And so we made some little coupons that on it said, sometimes it's just nice to know somebody cares. Have a great day from, and then our kids would put their name on it, or we'd put our name on it. And sometimes we'd just stop. In fact, one day we were driving down the road, and one of my sons, he says, hey, Dad, there's a guy out there in that park. He looks to me like he's really sad. Stop the car. So we pull off the start of the car. He jumps out and runs across the park and goes up to this guy. He says, here. And the guy goes, what's this, sonny? He says, just wanted you to know that I think you ought to have a good day. He says, well, thank you. Started laughing, patting him on the back. He came back and just hired a guy. Well, we had some great experiences. There were times when we wanted to go into big cities, little cities, different sizes to see what kind of reaction would occur. We pulled into this city of Eureka, and we planned to go to the beach and just go out and pick up garbage on the beach. And we're out there. We thought, gosh, we'll just do this for an hour or two, and then we'll go swimming and go back to the motel. And I swear, we couldn't go more than about 5 steps without somebody coming and saying, hi, how you doing? Good, good. What are you doing? Well, we're picking up garbage here on the beach. Oh, how come? Well, we just thought it'd be nice, clean it up. Oh, where are you from? Idaho. Idaho, and you're here in California cleaning up the beach? Yeah, well, and then we'd start telling about the story. I said, you're kidding. Really? You're just doing this? Yeah. Can we help? Pretty soon, I'll bet you we had a huge group of people walking up and down the beach. We had a group of teenagers who were having a party that came over with their arms full of, here's a bunch of garbage. Can we help out? It was contagious. It was so fun. And here were our kids. One day, we were driving along. My youngest son turns to my oldest son. He says, Brock, you know what I like best about you? What? Well, I love to tell him things. Oh, thanks, Creed. Jordan, you know what I like best about you? And the oldest brother then passed on. Pretty soon, every one of them passed a loving message to one another. My wife turned to me, and she looked at me with tears in her eyes, and she said, there is the miracle. The miracle wasn't for the people that we served. It was for us. And it changed our lives. So much so that when I came out of the hospital a couple months ago, my wife and I sat down, we talked about that feeling that we had lost, and I was telling her about how I'd do anything to get that peace back again. I said to her, I know what we could do to get some of it back. Let's kind of like go back on that vacation again, but let's just do it here. Let's see if we can just start doing something for other people. So we met with our kids and we said, hey, do you remember that experience? And everybody's going, yeah. And we said, let's start doing it. Let's go out and just doing something for somebody else, and then at the dinner table at night, we'll tell our stories. 2 days later, my oldest son comes in. He's a teenager, a jock at that. He came up to me and said, Dad, guess what happened at school today? I said, what? And he said, he's walking down the hall, and so there's a boy in our school that's kind of mentally retarded, and he says there's some kids who are teasing him, making fun of him, picking on him. He said, I went up to the kids, and I said, hey, guys, leave Joey alone. They said, why? He's a nerd. He's this and that. He's because he's my friend. And they said, oh, yeah. But then he says, leave him alone. And he said, why? Because he's my friend. He says, Dad, by the fifth time I finally said that, he says, finally they start laughing. He says, okay, I guess if he's your friend, Brock, we'll leave him alone. I guess he's okay. He says, they start laughing, walking down the hall. He said, Joey put his arm up on Brock's neck, and he looked at him and he said, Brock, why did you do that? Brock looked at him and he says, because Joey, you're my friend. I thought, that's the power of the message of these people. That's the power when we want to change a troubled youth. It's not give them more and more avenues to get away from the home. It's bring them back. Give them a chance to go out and do something for somebody else, and they'll love it. I watched that with my own kids, and I've watched my life be changed by tasting just a little of it. I just want you to know, I do know that there is a time of a society of peace coming. I am most certain of that. And I cannot wait to be a part of it. Thank you very much.
On tape two, we will be discussing some of the corollary material to what we've shared with you thus far in the seminar. One of the major points will be George Washington's vision while at Valley Forge, which we mentioned during the seminar, but didn't have time to discuss in its entirety. And we will be actually putting the entire vision of George Washington on this tape. Afterwards, we will also be sharing some of the quatrains from Nostradamus. Now, Nostradamus, of course, is one of the most noted prophets or seers of modern times, and much of his writing really deals with our day and time. Right now with me is my father, Senator Mel Richardson, who is also chairman of the board of American Family Institute, as well as my brother Mark Richardson, who for the past 20 years has been studying and researching ancient and modern works and how they deal with the prophecies and legends relating with our day and time. And indeed, American Family Institute, it is a family affair, and thus all three of us are involved with it. The vision of George Washington, Mel, is something obviously we have been so fascinated with, and yet most people have never heard of it.
Well, this is one of the things I'd like to bring out. Over the years that we've been doing seminars, radio programs, and the like, people have been saying, where did this come from? I mean, I went through schools, and I've never heard of the prophecy of George Washington. Now, all of a sudden, we have this beautiful prophecy, and it is outstanding. So I think the question needs to be answered, where did it come from, and how come we did not know about this before?
A very important question, and as Mel mentioned, I mean, it was a question we had in our mind when we first came upon it a number of years ago. And so we went to the Library of Congress, asked them to help us research to document, was it indeed a valid document? What they came back to us and told us after they researched it was this. It indeed had been published at least twice during the mid-1800s. Now, it came from a man named Anthony Sherman, who was an assistant to General George Washington. It was published, first off, by a man named Wesley Bradshaw. It was originally published in the Stars and Stripes, which at that time I think was known as the National Tribune. But at least twice, it was printed in the 1800s. Now, the Library of Congress came back to us after they researched. They said, listen, we cannot definitely say it is authentic, but we can authenticate the fact that indeed it was printed at least twice in the mid-1800s, and you'll have to take it from there. Well, that point of taking it from there, Mark, to me, one of the interesting aspects is the fact that at least once it was published before the Civil War ever occurred, and that's one thing that Washington saw in his vision.
And one of the things that the listeners are going to enjoy is you'll see him talk about three different wars, very clearly, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and then a war yet to come.
All right, with that, Mark, now let's set the stage for the vision.
George Washington, the father of our country, was a man of prayer. We've all read of how he went to the thicket many times to pray during the winter when his army was encamped at Valley Forge. However, little publicity has been given to a vision and a prophecy that he received at that time. It comes to us from a man named Anthony Sherman. He was an officer for General Washington. At the age of 99... at the year of 1859, he recounted the vision to a writer named Wesley Bradshaw. That article written by Bradshaw was later reprinted in the U.S. War Veterans paper, The National Tribune, which is now known as the Stars and Stripes. They were at the time at Independence Hall that Anthony Sherman recounted this to Wesley Bradshaw. While there, Anthony Sherman said, "Let us go into the hall. I want to tell you of an incident of Washington's life, one which no one alive knows except myself. And if you live, you will before long see it verified. Mark the prediction. You will see it verified. From the opening of the Revolution, we experienced all phases of fortune, now good, now ill, one time victorious, and another conquered. The darkest period we had, I think, was when Washington, after several reverses, retreated to Valley Forge, where he resolved to pass the winter of 1777. I have seen the tears coursing down our dear commander's careworn cheeks as he would be conversing with a confidential officer about the conditions of his poor soldiers. You have doubtless heard the story of Washington's going to the thicket to pray. Well, it was not only true, but he used to often pray in secret for aid and comfort, and God brought us safety through the darkest days of tribulation. One day, I remember it well. The chilly winds whistled through the leafless trees. Though the sky was cloudless and the sun shone brightly, he remained in his quarters nearly all the afternoon, alone. When he came out, I noticed that his face was a shade paler than usual, and there seemed to be something on his mind of more than ordinary importance. Returning after dusk, he dispatched an orderly to the quarters of an officer, who was presently in attendance. After a preliminary conversation about half an hour, Washington, gazing upon his companion with a strange look of dignity which he alone could command, said to the latter,
"I do not know whether it's owing to the anxiety of my mind or what, but this afternoon, as I was sitting at this table, engaged in preparing a dispatch, something in the apartment seemed to disturb me. Looking up, I beheld standing opposite me a singularly beautiful being. So astonished was I that I had given strict orders not to be disturbed that it was some moments before I found language to inquire the cause of the visit. A second, a third, and even a fourth time I did repeat my question, but received no answer from my mysterious visitor except a slight raising of the eyes. By this time I felt strange sensations spreading through me. I would have risen, but the riveted gaze of that being before me rendered volition impossible. I essayed once more to speak, but my tongue had become useless, as if paralyzed. A new influence, mysterious, potent, irresistible, took possession of me. All I could do was to gaze steadily, vacantly, at my unknown visitor. Gradually the surrounding atmosphere seemed to fill with sensations and grew luminous. Everything about me seemed to rarefy, the mysterious visitor also becoming more airy and yea, more distinct to my sight than before. I began to feel as one dying, or rather to experience the sensation which I have sometimes imagined accompanying death. I did not think, I did not reason, I did not move. All were alike impossible. I was only conscious of gazing fixedly, vacantly at my companion. Presently, I heard a voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." While at the same time my visitor extended an arm eastward, I now beheld a heavy white vapor at some distance, rising fold upon fold. This gradually dissipated, and I looked upon a strange scene. Laying before me, spread out in one vast plain, all the countries of the world, Europe, Asia, Africa, America. I saw rolling and tossing between Europe and America the billows of the Atlantic. Between Asia and America lay the Pacific. "Son of the Republic," said the mysterious voice as before, "look and learn." At that moment I beheld a dark, shadowy being, like an angel, standing, or rather floating, in mid-air between Europe and America. Dipping water out of the ocean in the hollow of each hand, he sprinkled some upon America with his right hand, while with his left he cast some over Europe. Immediately a cloud arose from these countries and joined in mid-ocean. For a while it remained stationary, and then it moved slowly westward until it enveloped America in its murky folds. Sharp hashes of lightning gleamed through it at intervals, and I heard the smothering groans and cries of the American people. A second time the angel dipped water from the ocean and sprinkled it out as before. The dark cloud was then drawn back to the ocean, in whose heaving billows it sank from view. A third time, the mysterious voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." I cast my eyes upon America and beheld villages and towns and cities springing up one after another until the whole land, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, was dotted with them. Again I heard the mysterious voice say, "Son of the Republic, the end of the century cometh. Look and learn." This time the dark, shadowy angel turned his face southward. From Africa I saw an ill-omened specter approaching our land. It flitted slowly and heavily over every town and city of the latter. The inhabitants presently set themselves in battle array against each other. As I continued looking, I saw a bright angel on whose brow rested a crown of light, on which was traced the word Union. He was bearing the American flag. He placed the flag between the divided nation and said, "Remember, ye are brethren." Instantly, the inhabitants, casting down their weapons, became friends once more and united around the national standard. Again I heard the mysterious voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." At this, the dark, shadowy angel placed a trumpet to his mouth and blew three distinct blasts, and taking water from the ocean, he sprinkled it upon Europe, Asia, and Africa. Then my eyes beheld a fearful scene. From each of these continents arose thick black clouds that were soon joined into one, and through this mass there gleamed a dark red light, which I saw hordes of men. Armed men, these men moving with the cloud, marched by land and sailed by sea to America, which country was enveloped in the volume of cloud. I dimly saw these vast armies devastate the whole country, burn the villages, the towns, the cities which I had seen springing up. As my ears listened to the thundering of the cannons, clashing of the swords, and the shouts and cries of millions in mortal combat, I again heard the mysterious voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." Where the voice had ceased, the dark, shadowy angel placed his trumpet once more to his mouth, and he blew a long, fearful blast. Instantly, a light as if a thousand suns shone down from above me and pierced and broke into fragments the dark cloud which enveloped America. At the same moment, the angel upon whose head had shone the words Union, and who bore our national flag in one hand and a sword in the other, descended from the heavens, attended by legions of white spirits. These immediately joined the inhabitants of America, and I perceived were well nigh overcome, but who immediately, taking courage once again, closed up their broken ranks and renewed the battle. Again, amid the fearful noise of the conflict, I heard the mysterious voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." As the voice ceased, the shadowy angel for the last time dipped water from the ocean and sprinkled it upon America. Instantly the dark cloud rolled back, together with the armies it had brought, leaving the inhabitants of the land victorious. Then, once more, I beheld the villages, towns, and the cities springing up where I had seen them before, while the bright angel, planting the azure standard he had brought in the midst of them, cried with a loud voice, "While the stars remain, and the heavens send down dew upon the earth, so long shall the Union last." And taking from his brow the crown on which blazoned the word Union, he placed it upon the standard, while the people kneeling down said, "Amen." The scene instantly began to fade and dissolve, and I, at last, saw nothing but the rising, curling vapor I at first beheld. This also disappeared, and I found myself once more gazing upon the mysterious visitor, who in the same voice that I had heard before said, "Son of the Republic, what you have seen is thus interpreted. Three great perils will come upon the Republic. The most fearful for her is the third. But the whole world united shall not prevail against her. Let every child of the Republic learn to live for his God, his land, and Union." With these words the vision vanished, and I started from my seat, and I felt that I had seen a vision wherein I had been shown the birth, the progress, the destiny of the United States.
The vision of General George Washington in Valley Forge, a most impressive piece. And when you look at what has taken place since that time and what is taking place and being led up to, it's quite significant. And Mark, it certainly seems to correlate with so many of the different cultures around the world and their views of what will take place in the future.
That's what makes all of this fascinating, is that we are looking at all of them referring to very similar or the exact same things. The destructions, the peace that comes afterwards, what is needed in order to keep it. The next one that we're going to be talking about, Nostradamus, equally talks about those things, those prophecies, those times.
Exactly, Mark, and you've studied quite extensively many of the books on his quatrains and the interpretations, and you've pulled out a number of the quatrains that you feel like would be most significantly dealing with what we've discussed and dealing with our day and time.
I'm referring to the quatrains that are referring to this day, and mainly to America as well, or to the war that would include America with other countries. And so these are the quatrains that we've pulled. I'm going to be quoting from authors from several different books, and so it isn't just one author or one commentary on it, but several. The first one, interesting, leads into all of this. Nostradamus says, "The scourge is past and the world shrinks. There will be peace for a long time and lands will decrease in population. One will travel safely by air, land, and through sea and wave, but then war will be stirred up again.
Of the three waters there will be born one that will make Thursday its holiday. Its fame, praise, rule, and power will grow by land and sea. It will appear as a tempest to the Orient. Henry Roberts, who is one of the authorities, one of the scholars on Nostradamus, said that the three waters refer to Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Gulf of Mexico. And so with the three waters there will be born a country or a nation that will rise from there, of course, that is America. Also, René Nürnbergen will say that the only country that has its national holiday on a Thursday is the United States.
I think that's very interesting. In fact, Mark, I went through the calendar today looking at that. It was a calendar that had many other countries' holidays. And indeed, the United States was the only one that had an official holiday on Thursday that was always on Thursday, being Thanksgiving.
So Nostradamus is saying that there will be this country, America, that will be born. Its fame, its praise, its rule and power will grow. And it will become a tempest to the Orient. Look at what has already happened with Japan.
Japan would probably say that, all right.
And a lot of things are going to refer to, I believe, China as well as we go through this. He goes on, sooner or later you shall see great changes, extreme horrors and persecutions, the moon led by her angel, the heaven draws near its inclination. Alas, how a great people shall be tormented, and the holy laws in total ruin by other laws, all Christianity troubled, when new mines of gold and silver will be found.
That's a powerful quatrain in my opinion, Mark. You look at that, the holy laws being in total ruin because of other laws. I think today we're seeing that quite a bit, which laws seem to supersede anything that is holy or continues to protect that which we would call God's law.
Two things commentators, different authorities see on this. One of them, the holy laws could be the Constitution, that it is being drugged down and destroyed. Others, where he's referring to Christianity being troubled, could be the biblical teachings and morals.
Right.
Those kind of things being destroyed by the morals of the people. So either way would be correct, and probably both would be correct.
Very much so.
Another one, very interesting, as you get into the troubled times in America, Nostradamus says, the temple where American citizens will place their treasures, that which is stored in a secret place, the hungry and starving will break the bonds to open the temple. Treasure will be retaken, the temple ravaged, a horrible riots in their midst.
Now, Mark, did Nostradamus actually say America in that quatrain?
No, that was actually the interpretation by René Nürnbergen. What Nostradamus said were the Hesperians, and that was her translation for the Hesperians, and many others agree with it, that it means the American citizens.
Now, that is also one that, Mark, you and I have discussed a great length, and it appears that there are those who could see either one of our viewpoints, being that when you talk about the temple of the American people, of where they would place their treasures, Fort Knox is the first thing that comes to my mind as being a place where clearly in the United States that's where we'd put treasure.
And Henry Roberts will agree with you. He felt that Fort Knox is a place that would be raided. To me, it seemed more of a general statement. Not just in one place, but across the country, as the temples would be raided. To me, that means, as René Nürnbergen says, it feels that it would be banks across the country.
Which
either one could be very likely.
Very much so, and certainly brings back memories of what took place just a few years ago here in the United States anyway.
The next set of quatrains that we're going to read from Nostradamus has to do more with the war itself. René Nürnbergen said, these really don't need any interpretation. They make sense. You can understand them for yourself, and I think you'll see that. Some of these will give some ideas of what they believed, but very fascinating sight and prophecy by Nostradamus. Nostradamus says, volcanic fire from the center of the earth will cause an earthquake around the new city. Two great rocks will oppose one another for a long time. Then rivers will turn red. Now, Henry Roberts says, the two great rocks at war can only mean east and west, Russia and the United States. And the earthquake and the fire in the new city must refer to a nuclear holocaust, which would be in New York City.
That doesn't have to stretch your imagination too far to see that that could be a possibility.
No, not a bit. Going just a little bit south from there, Nostradamus says, garden of the world near the new city, on the way to the man-made mountains. They will also be taken and plunged into the bay, its people forced to drink poison, stinking water.
Hmm.
Two different interpretations on what this can mean. René Nürnbergen says that according to a USGS study and a bulletin that was put out, a fault line runs underneath New York City and is really a part of a larger earth fracture that begins in Maine and runs all the way down beneath Boston and Philadelphia. One of the garden cities known in the world is Boston. And so she feels that this could be from an earthquake running through there. But Henry Roberts says it's very likely that an earthquake happens out into the ocean, creating a giant tidal wave that would come in and sweep some of these cities into the ocean.
And of course, Mark, he refers to the man-made mountains. Very possibly that would be skyscrapers. I mean, you think of his day and time never having seen the skyscraper. What a better description of a skyscraper, a man-made mountain.
Oh, yes. I'm sure that's what they would look like to someone from that day. This next quatrain by Nostradamus also ties in with this and starts to talk about a combination of countries going against America. He said, "The populated places will be made uninhabitable. Great discords to obtain food from fields. Lands will be governed by incapable officials. And among the great brothers, chaos and death."
Mark, I think this particular quatrain ties in more perfectly with all the other legends and prophecies of the other cultures that I have found than any other. Clearly, every single one of those lines, you can see exactly what these other people have been saying. The fact that the populated places would become uninhabitable. The fact that there would be great want for food, etc. And so, clearly, this one ties very closely into what we've talked about tonight.
Famines, unfortunately, are one that are referred to many times by Nostradamus, but also from many of the other prophecies, the legends that are spoken of across the world. This next one, again, will need really no major interpretation, as you will understand what it says. "There will be unleashed a life force, a secret form of death, horrible and frightful. It will be contained in globes. Launched from a fleet of ships, it will reduce a city to dust in a single night. Mm. The city ignites. The enemy offers peace. A great famine will be caused by a disease-producing wave. It will be carried by a lengthened rain coming from the Arctic Pole. A winged satellite will orbit 270 miles above the Earth when there will be no politics or existing under the laws of others."
Mark, this first part of that quatrain in which it talks about a secret form of death that is launched and contained in globes certainly brings to your mind the possibility of biological and chemical warfare in our day and time.
Oh, no question. And it says in the second quatrain, makes it seem that, and according to René Neuenbergen, it's very possible that this is something that is being sent, as it says, a winged satellite will orbit 270 miles above the Earth. That was actually stated by Nostradamus as 100 leagues from the hemisphere. A league was 2.7 miles, 100 leagues, 270 miles above the Earth. So it sounds like from some type of a space station or satellite, they would put out or drop some chemical or biological weapons above the Arctic. There it would catch the winds and the rain and would spread through Alaska, Canada, and the United States. And, of course, creating terrible plagues, death, famines. Mm. Terrible, the thought of what could happen.
I don't like that interpretation.
I don't think anybody does. The next one goes along the same line with the nuclear and biological weapons. "When Saturn and Mars, which stand for evil and war, are equally powerful, the air will be made very dry because of an elongated shooting star. Through secret fires, it will cause a great place to blaze with scorching heat. There will be little rain, but a hot wind during the war and invasions. Many will think they see the sun at night. They will also see deformed men, half animal, half human. Noise, sounds, battles, and fighting in the sky will be seen, and one will hear strange beasts talking."
You look at that, Mark. Deformed men, half animal, half human. Clearly, if there are biological, chemical, nuclear weapons being used, it could be deformities that occur within a person. Or it could be spacesuits or something like that.
According to Henry Roberts, the interpretation really should be, "When the half-hog man shall be seen." And Erica Chisholm, who is also one of the great scholars and wrote a book on Nostradamus, said the better interpretation would be, "When they see the half-pig man." She says this refers to also the modern warfare, but she says, imagine Nostradamus seeing a pilot with his helmet on and an oxygen mask coming out of his face.
Could look like a snout.
Yes, a half pig man. So half animal, half human, or part like that, as they're seeing men's heads coming out of automobiles, tanks, planes, things like that. It could look like sometime half animal, half man.
Machinery that they had never seen in their day and time. So, yeah, very clearly.
We mentioned earlier the great famines that are referred to by many of the cultures, as well as many times by Nostradamus. This next couple refer a lot to the tragedy and the terrible times that could befall this people. He says, "The great famine do I see drawing near, turning from one way to another, and then becoming universal, so great and long that they shall come to pluck the root from the wood and the child from the breast. The noise of the unwanted bird having been heard upon the cannon of the highest story, the bushel of wheat shall rise so high that man shall be a man-eater."
The last part certainly sounds that wheat may become so scarce that man turns to eating one another, becomes flesh-eating of their own kind, cannibal, because of the situation.
And this is what David Pitt Francis, another one of the great scholars who has written a book about Nostradamus and his writings, stated. He said the famine will be so bad that man will eat the bark from the tree to get nourishment.
Hmm.
Now, that is in the first quatrain where it said the root from the wood and the child from the breast. Interesting, the start of the second quatrain, the noise of the unwanted bird having been heard, evidently man and beast will be fighting for food. Everyone is trying to get it, the unwanted bird, because it is also going for the same food that man is, and a fight for survival. And as you said, the bushel of wheat shall rise so high, or shall be so scarce, that man shall become man-eater. These last two quatrains by Nostradamus, again, very interesting. The first one, you'll understand. It doesn't take a lot of interpretation. The second one, I think you'll also see exactly what he's saying. The first one, the king by a ruse shall know the ambushes. His enemies will attack from three directions. A strange number of tears will come to the eyes of the coughing ones when the empire will fail the leader of the foreign language.
Tears in the eyes of the coughing ones. Once again, that brings to your mind visions of what could take place with biological, chemical, nuclear-type weapons in our day and time.
Oh, definitely. Talking about that. Also, it says that when the empire will fail, the leader of the foreign nation, obviously referring to the country who is being attacked, in this case America, will finally conquer that from the foreign nations are coming against him. And tying in also that second line with George Washington's vision of the attack coming from three different directions, Europe, Asia, and Africa. And here Nostradamus says his enemies will attack him from three directions. A tie with those two together.
Yeah, it would.
This last quatrain that we're going to refer to in this tape, one that you don't like to hear, but is fascinating. After great human misery, greater approaches. When the great will of centuries is renewed, it will rain blood, milk, famine, war, and pestilence. And in the sky, one sees fire dragging a long trail of sparks.
Of course, the great will of centuries being renewed appears to be the beginning of our 21st century.
Exactly, that timing that he is showing. David Pitt Francis said a great war will break out at the beginning of the new century. And he says that Nostradamus gives a logical order for the process. A war, then the bloodshed, then the famine, and then the pestilence. Those tying in with the last sentence of the quatrain, in the sky one sees fire, dragging a long trail of sparks. He says this is a good description of chemical or nuclear war.
Mark, Nostradamus talked so much about the destruction and the problems that may be forthcoming. I just do want to mention one more time, there is the hope and the good side as well. And hopefully from this seminar and from this material, you've been able to see that as well, especially with those cultures and those who have had visions and legends of the future coming a time and a society of utter peace. That is the hope for the future, and hopefully you can take that message from this.
This has been the audio production of They Saw Our Day, researched and presented by Lance Richardson. Copyright 2000, American Family Publications, Idaho Falls, Idaho. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.